So let's start. What is water fluoridation? Water fluoridation is the addition of 1 milligram of fluoride ion per liter of water, that's one part per million, ostensibly to fight tooth decay. It's not added as the element. We're not talking about fluorine, the most reactive element on the periodic table. We're talking about fluoride. We're talking about a compound which has been made with fluorine reacting with something else. Something like sodium fluoride then would be a compound. The compound that is used for most of the water supplies, including Seattle, is a chemical called hexafluorosilicic acid. It doesn't occur naturally. It's produced in the scrubbing systems, which capture two nasty pollutants called hydrogen fluoride and silicon tetrafluoride, which for about 100 years decimated the local vegetation and brought cattle to their knees. Eventually, this industry was forced to capture that pollutant using a wet spray, and now that liquor, that scrubbing liquor containing these pollutants in the form of hexafluorosilicic acid, plus other things like cadmium and arsenic and lead and so on, is shipped to our public water supplies. They can't dump it into the sea by international law. They can't dump it locally because it's too concentrated. They need 180,000 gallons of water to mix with this liquor before they can get rid of it. And we, of course, have 180,000 gallons of water to mix with their hazardous waste. That may sound far-fetched. I'm not making that up. Most countries do not fluoridate their water. In fact, about half the people that are drinking fluoridated water live in the United States. These countries in Europe, the vast majority of European countries do not fluoridate the water. Austria, Belgium, Czech Republic, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Greece, Iceland, Italy, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Norway, and so on and so on and so on. Only three countries in Europe do this. England at 10%, 10% of the population. Spain between 3 and 10%. I don't know the latest figure. Ireland at 73%. Ireland has had mandatory fluoridation since 63 for the whole state. Some of these countries have fluoridated salt. They put the fluorine in the fluoride in the salt. None of the Scandinavian countries do that, nor do the Netherlands, nor do the Belgium. So those countries have no water fluoridation and no fluoridated salt. And yet their teeth are just as good, if not better, than ours. Three numbers I want you to just make a note of. If you're taking notes, make a note of these three numbers, or you may be able to remember them. The first number is 0.006 parts per million. That's the level of fluoride in mother's milk. That's the level which Mother Nature, or evolution, however you want to call this, over millions of years determined was needed for the baby's first meal. Right away it tells you that fluoride is not a nutrient, because if it is a nutrient, then nature screwed up. And I don't believe that nature did screw up. I think nature probably had quite good reasons for keeping fluoride away from the newborn baby, and I will talk about that more later. The next level is one part per million. One part per million is the level at which we add fluoride to the water, the level at which the Center for Disease Control aggressively advocates, sends their representatives out to states like Oregon, like Arkansas, like New Jersey, to support mandatory statewide fluoridation. They were doing that last year. One part per million. Now, some people say, well, this is a teeny-weeny amount. One part per million is just 1 cent in $10,000. What you have to remember is that it's 200 times, approximately, higher than mother's milk. And Bill alluded to this. This means that a bottle-fed baby is getting 200 times more fluoride than nature intended. A bottle-fed baby is getting 200 times more fluoride than nature intended. Now, why I think that's incredibly important information is that what we know is that fluoride normally can't get through the blood-brain barrier. But when the baby is first born, the blood-brain barrier is not fully formed. And therefore, the potential exists that the fluoride will get into the brain at this very early and sensitive age. In fact, that is the reason that Dr. Arvid Carlsson gave for opposing fluoridation in Sweden. He later went on to get the Nobel Prize in the year 2000. That's the reason he gave in 1978. He says, I am concerned about what it means for a newborn baby to get over 100 times the level of fluoride than it would get in mother's milk. The next number you need to know is 4 parts per million. 4 parts per million is the current maximum contaminant level in drinking water of fluoride. Now, the CDC treats it as fluoride as a beneficial additive, whereas the EPA treats it as a toxic pollutant. And if you have more of it than 4 parts per million, then by law, you have to remove it. That's the current situation. And so we are operating between adding it at 1 part per million, supposedly to do some good, and removing it above 4 parts per million to prevent it doing harm. Well, right there, as somebody who's dabbled in toxicology, I say the whole thing is crap. Because you can't operate between 1 and 4. Why? Because you're not giving people a liter of water to drink and say, this is 1 part per million, drink this 1 liter of it, don't, and all the rest of your water you drink without fluoride, and of course don't get other fluoride from any other sources, and you'll be okay. We're not doing that. We're saying to people, we're putting it in your water, drink as much as you want. In fact, some people drink 5 or 6 liters of water a day. And this goes back to what Bill is saying, we're overdosing ourselves with fluoride. Now the situation gets worse, because the National Research Council, at the invitation of the EPA, has spent 3 years, and this was the first truly independent panel, truly balanced, not independent, balanced, where we had people that were both opposed to fluoridation, for fluoridation, and neutral, looking at this issue in 60 years. Nearly all the other things have been rubber stamps for a policy which is supported by the US Public Health Service. They looked at this for 3 years, and they said to the EPA, you should lower the MCLG. You should lower the MCLG. They didn't tell them what to lower it to, but they said you should do a health risk assessment. And they've made it easy for the EPA to do a health risk assessment, because they provided an exposure analysis in Chapter 2, and they provided them a lot of documentation about what levels of fluoride affect different tissues in the body. Let me go on. So now we're operating not between 1 and 4, but at most 1 and 2. I say at most because they said that severe dental fluorosis is a health effect, and that they've indicated that above 2 parts per million you will get too much severe dental fluorosis. So 2 would be the maximum. Now we're going to be trying to operate between 1 and 2. Now I want to explain how this MCLG was determined in 1985. This is how the EPA determined it. This is the maximum level goal. This is the best science. This is to use the best science that they can to determine a level of the water which will be protective, not just of the average person, but the most sensitive person, against not just definite health effects, but likely health effects. This is how they did it. The first assumption was that the only health point of concern was crippling skeletal fluorosis. That means when the poisoning of the bones by fluoride, which is very common in places like India and China, has reached the point where your whole backbone is frozen and you can't move and you go walk around like that. And you indicate, you know when this is happening, because people can't touch their hands behind their neck and they can't touch the neck to their chest. But there are several phases of this. And the EPA incredibly ignored the first two phases of this and settled on only the crippling phase being of health concern, ignoring the fact that the first symptoms of fluoride's poisoning of the bone is just like arthritis. And we have 68 million Americans now with arthritis. Whether that's got anything to do with fluoride, we don't know, because they haven't done the research. The second point, the second thing they did is to say, what is the lowest effect level? What is the lowest level that could cause this disease, crippling skeletal fluorosis? They said 20 milligrams per day. The next thing they did is to say, let's use a safety factor to protect not just the healthy workers in industry that developed this condition in Denmark in 1937. That's the data that they were using, incidentally, how up-to-date the EPA was. They said, we need a factor to protect all the people in society, the infants, the babies, the elderly, the sick, and the people with kidney dysfunction. And look what safety factor they came up with, 2.5. 2.5 would take care of the whole population. And next, they assumed that the only source of fluoride was water. They didn't assume that people were getting fluoride from anything else, pesticide residues or dental products. It was only coming from water. And then they said, we'll assume that people drink just 2 liters of water a day. So here's the calculation. 20 milligrams a day, safety factor of 2.5, 8 milligrams per day is safe for everybody, and we assume that people drink 2 liters of water a day. If you divide 8 by 2, you can have 4 milligrams per liter, and that supposedly is safe. Every single one of those assumptions is bad. Crippling skeletal fluorosis is not the first impact of fluoride on the bone. It is not the only tissue that's impacted by fluoride. They knew that in 1985. The low L of 20 milligrams per day is wrong. At most, it's 10 milligrams per day for that impact. A safety factor of 2.5 is absolutely toxicological nonsense. It does not protect the whole range of the population. You need a factor of at least 10 to do that. The notion that no other source of fluoride is in our daily lives is rubbish, and they knew that in 1985, because guess what? We were using fluoridated toothpaste in 1985. And the assumption that we only drink 2 liters of water a day is rubbish. In fact, the Institute of Medicine actually advises people to drink 3 liters of water. So I'm on every single count, this is wrong. So that you didn't need rocket science. You didn't actually need 12 people working for 3 years to tell the EPA to lower this MCLG. But thank goodness they did. They lowered it. We don't know what to. The National Research Council, by the way, is the research arm of the National Academy of Sciences. In 2003, the US EPA asked the NRC to review the MCLG. This is going back. And it was on March the 22nd that they released this 450-page report in which they recommended that the MCL should be lowered and they should perform a new health risk assessment to find out what the new MCLG should be. We've said that already. March the 22nd, this year. Within a few days, precisely 6 days, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a statement declaring that the NRC findings have no relevance to water fluoridation, and to continue to claim what they've claimed like robots for the last 50 years, that it's safe and effective, safe and effective, safe and effective. The CDC didn't have time to read that report, study that report, scientifically assess that report. They didn't have time to go to all the references which the NRC threw at them for the first time, and they certainly didn't have time to do their own health risk assessment to come back with what a new MCLG should be. So this wasn't a scientific judgment. What this is, ladies and gentlemen, is a very clear, I'm glad they did that, because it's very clear that they are working to some other agenda here. They're not working to protect the public here. Maybe it's just protecting the policy or whatever. But you can't convince me that that was 6 days later to say it's not relevant to water fluoridation. It's absolute, incidentally, it's absolutely poppycock to say that. The exposure analysis makes it very, very clear that people drinking 1 part per million fluoride, there are some people drinking 1 part per million fluoride that are getting too much fluoride, period. That's their exposure analysis. And they got several chapters worth of what the damage would be, which the CDC has ignored for many years. Now, how reliable then is the CDC? It will undoubtedly be used by newspaper editorialists to say that this is perfectly safe. But in 1999, this same agency told the world that fluoridation is one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. Well, that's quite a statement. That has been quoted to me in Australia, New Zealand, England, Ireland, Canada, throughout the world. There's hardly a day that doesn't go by that that statement is not mentioned by a local official or a local editorial writer. Now, my son and I decided to look at the statement on which this was based, and you can find a critique on our webpage. In short, it's extremely poor. And what we found out, it's been written, it was just written by one dentist A guy called Scott Tomar is now in Florida promoting fluoridation. One dentist. This is how they describe the health. The safety and effectiveness of water fluoridation have been reevaluated frequently, and no credible evidence supports an association between fluoridation and any of these conditions, a long list that they cite from opponents. Then there's a reference there. See that 25? Let's go and see reference 25. Reference 25 is the National Research Council looked at the MCLG of 4 parts per million at the request of the EPA in 1993. Do you sense a certain double standard here? In 1999, they cite the NRC's review of the MCLG as being evidence that it's safe and hunky-dory. In 2006, when the NRC comes back and says it's not safe, they say, nothing to do with water fluoridation. But also note this. This agency, where these individuals working here get paid more money than I do, and probably more than most of you get paid, was 6 years out of date on the health literature. What about all the studies that were published between 1993 and 1999 when they made this statement? I couldn't be talking here tonight if I was 6 years behind on the literature. These guys should, they're protecting us. This is their policy. They're promoting this. They shouldn't be more than 6 weeks out of date on the literature. They should be on top of every article in every journal and in every language. And if they can't be, then they shouldn't be working there. It's what we pay them for. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Right? They're working for us. That ain't working for us if they're going to tell us that something is safe and they're 6 years behind the data. No, no, no. That's not right. Now here's the center of the same paper. Look at them describe the benefits of fluoridation. They have this graph. This is the only figure in the whole document. And it has a blue line here. This is the mean DMFT. This is tooth decay in 12-year-olds. Decayed, missing, and filled teeth. And you notice that that is going down from the 60s to the 90s. And you notice also there's another line on this graph, which is the percentage of the US population drinking fluoridated water. Voila! This is coming down because this is going up. The sale of telephone directories was also going up. So was the sale of coffee and bicycles. But it doesn't mean that that line is necessarily connected with that line. However, I mean, this is a very basic problem with epidemiology, etc., etc., etc. Everybody in 101 epidemiology is told not to assume that a correlation means cause and effect, right? But they could have checked this out because the World Health Organization makes available online tooth decay in 12-year-olds in practically every industrialized country in the world. So they could have tried this out and looked at how tooth decay in 12-year-olds was coming down in other countries. Let's do that. We got the data from the World Health Organization and we plotted it out. Here it is. Here is the tooth decay coming down in the same period, the same measurement, decayed, missing, and filled teeth in 20 countries. Here's the United States line. Of these 20 countries, only four are fluoridated. 16 are not fluoridated. Let me remind you what the CDC said. That line is coming down because the percentage of the U.S. population drinking fluoridated water is going up. This is what the data says. Regardless of whether you've got fluoridation or not, tooth decay has been coming down in industrialized countries, probably as a function of standard of living, possibly as a function of the availability of fluoridated toothpaste, and perhaps many other things. But to claim by the CDC that line is coming down because the percentage of the U.S. population is going up, when you have that data, is either incompetence or worse, is fraud. The most powerful argument used to promote fluoridation, what is it? It is, we must do this for poor kids whose families cannot afford proper dental care. And that is the real issue, incidentally. The reason that we have dental decay that we have in the United States is largely because poor families cannot afford dental treatment. Coupled with the fact that 80% of dentists in this country will not treat children on Medicaid. However, what they say is, look, by putting fluoride into the water, it goes to everyone, regardless of income. It goes to the low income, it goes to the middle income, it goes to the high income. It's equitable. Now that superficially works. It's beguiling. We all want to help the poor, right? But is it right? No, of course it isn't. These arguments are emotionally appealing, but dangerously misconceived. Why? There are three reasons. Number one, it's precisely poor families who cannot afford avoidance measures. They cannot afford bottled water for cooking and drinking or reverse osmosis, number one. They can't afford, they're trapped. And number two, they can't afford the expensive treatment of dental fluorosis that Bill was talking about, $16,000, $24,000. No, they have to lump it. They have to live with it. And that's equitable. And lastly, what we know, and it's very well established in the literature, that fluoride's toxic effects are worse for people with poor nutrition. Poor, low calcium, low minerals, low vitamins, low proteins. All of these things make fluoride's toxicity worse. Where are you likely to get poor nutrition in the United States? In families of low income. So please don't swallow this one. It's not equitable. It's in fact very punitive. Okay, the risks. Studies in the peer-reviewed and published literature indicate that fluoride, as we've heard, causes dental fluorosis, causes bone damage, arthritic symptoms, and hip fractures, particularly in the elderly, may cause osteosarcoma in young men, accumulates in the human pineal gland, lowers thyroid function, causes brain damage, causes kidney damage, causes reproductive effects, and some people are hypersensitive to low doses. About 1% of the population appears to be sensitive to 1 milligram of fluoride. Now, of course, immediately you produce a list like this, the question you should ask is, but at what dose? But at what dose? Are these very, very high doses? Are these doses that cause this relevant to water fluoridation? And that's the task. That was the big task of the NRC, to come up with the doses in these different studies. The dose at which where damage occurs. Proponents argue that if any of these effects occur, and usually they deny that, they do so only at high doses. The trouble with that statement is they don't tell you what high doses means. And they don't specify what a high dose is, and they don't distinguish, usually, between the concentration of fluoride in the water, which can be tightly controlled by engineers, and the dose in milligrams per day, which cannot be controlled by engineers, but only on the will of the people. And more importantly, they don't often talk about dosage. That's milligrams per kilogram body weight. For example, the assumption that 8 milligrams, if it's safe for an adult, would be safe for an infant, a 7-kilogram infant, is rubbish. We know that children, young children, are much more sensitive to toxics than adults. And so you've got to talk about milligrams per kilogram body weight per day. And moreover, they don't discuss the critical need for a margin of safety. So yes, it's right. You know, everything's toxic at high doses. This is Paracelsus. It's the poison that makes it's the dose which makes the poison. But if a bona fide toxicologist or pharmacologist addresses that issue, low doses are some good for you, but high doses are bad for you, what they want to know is the margin of safety. That's the thing, or the therapeutic index. Margin of safety. You very seldom see a discussion of this in any pro-fluoridation literature. When exposing a whole population to a therapeutically active substance, ideally we would want a margin of safety, sometimes referred to a therapeutic index, between the toxic dose and the therapeutic dose of 100. Why would you need that number? Answer: because we would like a factor of 10 to allow for the range of sensitivities throughout the population. That's what we call intraspecies variation. And we would want another factor of 10 to allow for the variation in dose that people are going to get across the thing. At least a factor of 100. So now let's look at the effects, at what levels the effects take place. And having told you to distinguish between concentration and dose and dosage, I'm going to give it this first round in terms of parts per million. What have we observed in animal and human studies at certain parts per million? Here we go. And incidentally, this is the centerpiece of the risk on arguments. And once we've got this down, I'm going to go through some of the details on some of these studies. At one part per million, we have an increased uptake of aluminium into rat brain. It, by the way, is aluminium. You Yanks mispronounce it. Alcoa made a spelling mistake. Alcoa made a spelling mistake at the early part of the 20th century, and it's stuck ever since. Sodium, potassium, rubidium, francium, vanadium, soda, calcium, barium, strontium, radium, eum, aluminum. You're wrong. But don't feel too badly about it, because there's a word that you get right and all the Brits get wrong. And so do the Australians. Vitamins. They go around saying vitamins. Vitamins comes from vital amines. So the Yanks are right on that one. So don't feel too bad about it. Okay. Anyway, so this is a study done by Varner, and I should be talking more about that in a moment. The details now. Well, we're in a good position. Normally, I would have referred you to the Fluoride Action Net website, /health. Because we've documented all the health effects by tissue, and it's very easy to get these papers, the abstracts, the full papers, and so on. But now I don't have to do that. Instead, I urge you to go and read this 450-page report from the National Research Council, because it is a textbook. It is a textbook on fluoride toxicity, the best that's been done to date. Fluoride in the brain. There's an excellent chapter on the brain, chapter 7. In the National Research Council review. There are 30 studies which indicate that fluoride damages the brain. One of them is this study by Varner, and they fed rats one part per million of fluoride in their water for 1 year. One group got aluminium fluoride, and the other group got sodium fluoride. And those animals developed kidney damage, brain damage, greater uptake of aluminium into the brain, and beta amyloid deposits, which are characteristic of Alzheimer's disease. When someone dies and you think they've got Alzheimer's disease, the way you prove it is to autopsy the brain, and if you find those beta amyloid plaques, then they died of Alzheimer's disease. If you don't, then it's senile dementia of some other kind. So the fact that we can give that to rats simply by feeding them fluoride at one part per million is pretty striking, to say the least. The NRC conceded this study. They talked about that study. And they also talked about something else. They said fluorides also increase the production of free radicals in the brain through several different biological pathways. These changes have a bearing on the possibility that fluorides act to increase the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. So they went beyond the Varner study. And they talked about studies that should be done to investigate this. And I will come back to this, but just think about this for a moment. You are fluoridating right now the water of 160 million Americans. And we've got to the point that we want a study to see if this causes Alzheimer's disease. What do we say to people 5 years from now when we get a definitive study which shows that this is actually true, and it just isn't just rats, but it's humans? What do we say to the thousands of new Alzheimer's cases that might have been avoided if we had acted with some degree of caution earlier on? That's incidentally why we have the precautionary principle. More about that later. A few epidemiological studies of Chinese populations have reported IQ deficits in children exposed to fluoride at 2.5 to 4 parts per million in the drinking water. Although the studies lacked sufficient detail for the committee to fully assess their quality and relevance to the United States populations, the consistency of the results appears significant enough to warrant additional research on the effects of fluoride on intelligence. So we want more studies to look at the effect of fluoride on our children's intelligence. What do we tell our children 5 years from now if we confirm those Chinese studies? Whoops, sorry. Here are some of the IQ studies from China, and the one I've already drawn attention... Oh, this one I want to particularly draw your attention to. This is a study done in 1991 in which They looked at IQ deficits in iodine shortage, or in areas with iodine shortage. And what they found is that where there was borderline iodine shortage, if the parents, the mother, and the children were also exposed to moderate amounts of fluoride, 0.9 parts per million, it had even greater lowering of the IQ in those children. So a lack of iodine exacerbates the impact of fluoride. Now, this is the study I want to talk a little bit more about. Zhang, I had problems with some of the other Chinese studies because they didn't control for lead. And they didn't control for iodine, both of which can cause problems with IQ. He did. He controlled for lead, and he controlled for iodine. And he found a lowering of IQ, and he estimated that this occurred when he extrapolated from his village of 2.5. They looked at the data. He said that the effect seems to be occurring at 1.8. That's when you would expect to see it in his study. And later on in September last, he gave a presentation which he now says the IQ deficit correlates with the fluoride levels in the blood, which brings it one step closer to cause and effect. The NRC, what they have done is very important here, because basically they're saying, you know, IQ studies are not sensitive enough. We need to break down the various aspects of intellectual development into reasoning ability, problem solving, etc. We need a much more careful look at these. And Zhang, I know, and when I was with him in China, they really want people to work with them on this study. They got the ideal experimental area, because they have all these villages which are essentially the same in terms of income, housing, occupations, diet, with one variable, that the fluoride differs in their well water. So it's a wonderful place to do all these studies. Some of their studies have had weaknesses, but they want to work with us. And the irony was that Zhang works for the Center of Disease Control and Prevention in China, where that agency is trying to take fluoride out of the water and is doing studies to find out at what level they've really got to take the fluoride out. Whereas our Center for Disease Control and Prevention is desperately trying to put fluoride into our water. Fluoride and the endocrine system. Chapter 8 in the NRC review deals with the endocrine system. One of the things they talked about is the pineal gland. The pineal gland is in the center of the brain between the two hemispheres. Why it's of concern is it's not protected by the blood-brain barrier. It's outside the brain in that sense. It has a very high perfusion rate of blood, which means a lot of fluoride can go into it. And thirdly, it's a calcifying tissue, just like the bones and the teeth. It lays down these crystals of calcium hydroxyapatite, which is like a magnet for fluoride. And Jennifer Luke, what the pineal gland does is to convert the natural amino acid tryptophan in four steps to melatonin. And melatonin is an incredibly important hormone, which is like a biological clock. It regulates all kinds of things in the body. Age of puberty, jet lag, sleep patterns, aging, possibly implicated in cancer. There's a huge amount of research going into the significance of melatonin levels in the human body and the timing of those levels. In 1997, Jennifer Luke, as a dentist, confirmed that fluoride accumulates in the human pineal gland. She got 11 corpses, had the pineal gland taken out, and analyzed the fluoride and found up to average of 9,000 parts per million on the crystals, going up as high as 21,000 parts per million. This is higher than somebody with crippling skeletal fibrosis would have in their bones. So this little gland is, as I said, like a magnet for fluoride. That was published in 2001. The second part of her thesis has not been published in the open literature yet, but she found that treating Mongolian gerbils with fluoride produced lower melatonin production in a very smooth circadian way, by the way. So the melatonin is only produced at night, the hormone of darkness, only produced at night. So she did a 24-hour cycle, and you get the production of melatonin at those periods of darkness. And then when she did the fluoride, it was like this. It was very, very smooth. And she also found what she would have predicted was that the time to reach puberty was shorter. when she looked around in the literature, she came across the Newburgh-Kingston study. This was the second trial of fluoride in the United States, water fluoridation. They fluoridated Newburgh, they didn't fluoridate Kingston. And they studied the children there for 10 years. And what they found was that the young girls in fluoridated Newburgh were menstruating on average 5 months earlier than the young girls in Kingston. It was dismissed at the time as not being significant. In retrospect, it may have been significant. Jennifer Luke, by the way, is not suggesting that fluoride is the main cause of the earlier puberty in this country, but obviously it has to be a candidate. It may exacerbate other chemicals in this respect. Now, I want you to read about the significance of this finding. By the way, these corpses, these people lived in London, which is not fluoridated, so you don't need a big source of fluoride to accumulate in your pineal gland. Recent information on the role of the pineal organ in humans suggests that any agent that affects pineal function could affect human health in a variety of ways, including effects on sexual maturation, calcium metabolism, parathyroid function, postmenopausal osteoporosis, cancer, and psychiatric disease. I think that's fairly significant. However, not one single government in this world has bothered to repeat that study. Not difficult to do. Not one. Not one fluoridating country. Not Australia, not New Zealand, not Ireland, not England, not the United States. They've had a thesis, they know these studies, and they haven't repeated it. Haven't attempted to. In fact, the Medical Research Council, that beautiful, wonderful, prestigious agency in the UK, the Medical Research Council actually gave a lower priority for research on the pineal gland with respect to fluoride than investigating the psychological response of children to dental fluorosis. They gave more attention to more research on teeth than they did on reproductive system, on the kidney, on the brain, and on the endocrine system. This is another agency that is supposedly protecting our health. Give me a break. Fluoride and thyroid. European doctors have used sodium fluoride as a means to reduce thyroid activity in patients with hyperthyroidism, overactive thyroid gland. And in fact, the doses that there are better drugs now, so they don't use it. But when they were using it, this study by Galletti and Joyer, a dose of 2.3 to 4.5 milligrams of fluoride per day, which is currently exceeded in our one part per million communities, according to the NRC, was enough to lower the thyroid function. Now, the response at the time to these kind of criticisms was that, well, it's possible that fluoride lowers the activity of somebody with a wonky thyroid gland, like a hyperthyroid, but it doesn't have any impact on the normal thyroid. They said that. But in 1985, Bajinski and co-workers found that normal people drinking 2.3 parts per million fluoride impacted their thyroid function. Now, when we sent that paper down to the EPA as part of our opposition to the use of sulfural fluoride as a fumigant on food that Bill talked about, they dismissed every single study we sent down to them. All the studies subsequently have been reviewed by the NRC, which did not dismiss all of our studies. But do you know what reason they gave for dismissing this study? Wait for it. They dismissed this study because it was in Russian. That is our EPA pesticide division. In humans, effects on the thyroid function were associated with fluoride exposures very low, and even lower if there was low iodide. I want you to look at that number, 0.01 to 0.03, and compare that with the safe dosage that you could derive for an adult. Remember, after applying the 2.5 factor to 20 milligrams per day, you get down to 8 milligrams per day. If you divide that by a 70 kilogram body weight, that is the so-called safe dosage for a human that the EPA has been using since 1985. This is the level at which you may lower the thyroid function if you're iodine deficient. But I didn't think seriously about that, because who believes there's an iodine deficiency in the United States? We all have iodized salt, right? We don't have an iodine deficiency. Or do we? According to the Center of Disease Control, we do. We have about 10 million people in the United States who are iodine deficient. And the NRC drew attention to something else. Intake of nutrients such as calcium and iodine often is not reported in studies of fluoride effects. The effects of fluoride on thyroid function, for instance, might depend on whether iodine intake is low, adequate or high, or whether dietary selenium is adequate. So they're saying, hey, when you do these studies, it's not enough just to look at the fluoride that people are getting, but the levels of calcium, the levels of iodine, the levels of selenium, and so on. In other words, all the studies that have been done for now have been crap. And this is a U.S. public health policy which has been going on since 1950, and they just haven't done the decent studies. They haven't done the right studies. Well, I won't know why. Do you know why? And dental fluorosis rates, this is important. When they started fluoridation, they anticipated that 10% of the kids would get dental fluorosis in its mildest form as a result of fluoridating in the water. 10% in its mildest form. That was the trade-off. You would lower tooth decay, but 10% of your kids would have very mild dental fluorosis. And I don't think they would even bother, Bill, to have veneers put on that condition. But now, the largest survey done in the United States says 29.9% of U.S. children living in fluoridated communities have dental fluorosis on at least two teeth, and not all in the very, very mild condition. Our kids are being overexposed. Here is the table. So you see that kids, even in non-fluoridated areas, are up to 21.6 of them have dental fluorosis in non-fluoridated communities, 3.1% in the mild category, 1.2% in the moderate category, and if you look at the optimally fluoridated areas, this is up to 29.9%. The NRC recommends that severe dental fluorosis is now should be considered a health effect. Now, the proponents of fluoridation always dismiss dental fluorosis as just a cosmetic effect. You know, it may not look too good in some cases, but it doesn't hurt the function of the tooth. But, of course, what people have said are a little bit more rational than these folks, who are concerned about more tissues than teeth, have said, yeah, that's what we can see. But if it's doing that to your teeth, what is it doing to other tissues in your body, like your brain, your thyroid function, the pineal gland, and so on and so on and so on? That's the key question. It's a biomarker of overexposure. And this is where this study comes in. A key question is, you know, when it's causing dental fluorosis, what's it doing to your children's bones, brains, and other tissues? We got one answer from Mexico. Larson Herrera and co-workers looked at children in the Guadiana Valley, which is naturally fluoridated at high levels, and they found a remarkable correlation between the frequency of bone fractures in children with the severity of dental fluorosis. In other words, they were using dental fluorosis as a biomarker. The more fluoride exposure, the more severe the dental fluorosis. The more severe the dental fluorosis, the more bone fractures in those children. Now, as I say, the NRC found weaknesses in that study, but what should be recognized is that that's exactly what we should be doing in the United States. We should be looking at all these suspected health concerns for children as a function of the severity of dental fluorosis to see if there are any correlations with IQ deficits, early puberty, etc., etc., etc. It's crying out. It's basic. It's common sense. It hasn't been done. Fluoride in children's bone. It was interesting that they found that because in that first Newberg-Kingston study, what they found was a higher incidence of cortical bone defects in the children in fluoridated Newberg. Double as much, approximately. The cortical bone is the outside layer of the bone. It's the outside layer of the bone which protects against fracture. And so if you're producing flaws in the cortical bone, then you would predict increased fractures, or at least that would be what I would predict. Now, interestingly enough, that's not how they reacted to this. A gentleman called Caffé, who was the guy that took the x-rays and analyzed the x-rays, what he noted was that the age, sex, and anatomical distribution of these bone defects are strikingly similar to osteosarcoma. They called it osteogenic sarcoma in those days. While progression of cortical defects to malignancies has not been observed clinically, it would be important to have direct evidence that osteosarcoma rates in males under 30, my emphasis, have not increased with fluoridation. Now, this comes from a National Academy of Sciences review in 1977, and the author is in the room right now. Donald Taves wrote that. Very perceptive in 1977. We should look to see if osteosarcoma rates have increased in males under 30 in fluoridated communities. It took the United States another 13 years before they even got close to following up Donald Taves' suggestion. The first thing they did it look at, eventually at rats. And they dosed rats, and they found a dose-related increase in osteosarcoma in male rats, not the female rats. But never worry, because they dug up an old paper by Procter and Gamble which didn't find a dose-related increase in osteosarcoma. They did find some osteosarcoma, but it was not dose-related increase. So one study negates the other, so we're told. Then in 1991, the National Cancer Institute decided to look. So 14 years after Donald suggested it, they looked at the cancer incidence registries, which covers 10% of the United States population, the so-called SEER inventory, and they found that there was a greater increase in osteosarcomas in young men, not young women, in the fluoridated communities than in the non-fluoridated communities. The same author of that, Hoover, also then went on to discount this finding on the basis that a smaller subset those increases did not relate to the duration of exposure. And this has been used to essentially negate this. Except people that have looked at this have said that that was not sufficient grounds to negate that finding. It didn't have, by the time you went to a subset and you divided it up into four different duration exposures, you didn't have the statistical power anymore. But nevertheless, it's worked. Then, 1 year later in New Jersey, Perry Cohn found a six-fold greater increase in osteosarcomas in young men, but not young women, in fluoridated communities compared with non-fluoridated communities in three New Jersey counties. And Perry Cohn made a very, very important observation. He said maybe there's a window of vulnerability for these children, a window of vulnerability, when they're particularly vulnerable to fluoride. And next thing is that there were several epidemiological studies of mixed quality which did not find this relationship, and this was used to say there was no association with fluoridation and osteosarcoma. And then in 2001, Dr. Elise Basson, another dentist, took her PhD at Harvard, and she investigated this. And what she found was, she found what Perry Cohn suggested, that if young boys were exposed to fluoridated water in their 6th, 7th, and 8th years, they had a significant increase in developing osteosarcoma by the age of 20. Nobody had used this way of looking at the data before. 2001. Nobody had heard of that. Why? Because her thesis advisor, Professor Chester Douglas, had on three occasions hid it from the scientific community. He gave a talk in England where he said, my work shows no relationship between fluoridation and osteosarcoma. He didn't bother to talk about Basson's thesis, which completely contradicted that. Then he sent a report to his funders at the NIH. He says, my work does not show a relationship between fluoridation and osteosarcoma. This time he gave her work as a footnote, as a reference. But those guys in Bethesda, Maryland, would have had to take a plane from Maryland to Boston, gone to the Harvard University, go to the rare book section of the library, and got out a thesis and read it. Bill did that. Before they found out that the footnote was totally contradicting what he said. Well, who is Chester Douglas? He's a consultant for Colgate, and he edits their oral health report, and this has all been written up in the major Wall Street Journal and Washington Post and so on. He's being investigated right now. But believe it or not, the NRC is waiting for Douglas to produce a report this scoundrel who's hidden these results from the scientific community for 4 years. I mean, this is pretty serious, isn't it? If you were in industry, you would get put in prison. Because if you're in industry and they find out that one of your chemicals is causing damage to health of the workers, if you don't report that in a few days, you can be in court. But he let this go on for 4 years. I don't know how many years it would have gone on for if my son hadn't gone to Harvard Library and found that thesis. And this is something, osteosarcoma is rare, but it's frequently fatal. So we're talking lives here. We're talking lives. Let me quickly talk about the benefits. Fluoride prevents dental caries predominantly after eruption of the tooth into the mouth, and its actions primarily are topical. This is one good thing that's come out of the CDC. They've actually admitted that the benefits of fluoride, such that exist, are topical. You don't have to swallow it. That admission should have ended fluoridation right there. If the benefits don't come from swallowing, why put it in the water? Fluoridated toothpaste maximizes the topical benefits and minimizes the systemic risks, whereas fluoridated water maximizes the systemic risks and minimizes topical benefits. Try it out. Drink a glass of water. See how much touches your teeth. Swallowing fluoride makes as much sense as swallowing sunblock to protect the skin from the sun's rays. As much sense as chewing condoms to have safe sex. The largest survey of dental disease in the United States, which looked at 39,000 children in 84 communities, this is sponsored by the National Institute of Dental Research. What did they find? They found an average difference in tooth decay in children aged 5 to 17 who lived all their lives in fluoridated versus non-fluoridated communities of 0.6 of one tooth surface out of an average of 100 tooth surfaces in a child's mouth, and they didn't even show that that was statistically significant. 0.6. Here's the table. Here's the table. Here's the average. Decayed, missing, and filled surfaces in the no-water fluoridation, 3.39. 2.79 in the fluoridated community. Take 2.79 from 3.39. You're looking at 0.6 of one tooth surface. There are five tooth surfaces on a tooth. That's what the angst is all about. We're going to take the chances of our kids developing osteosarcoma, brain damage, thyroid function dislocation, etc., 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 because dentists think that saving 0.6 of a tooth surface could possibly justify that. Notice how the authors of that report, who work for the National Institute of Dental Research, describe their findings. They didn't mention 0.6. I mentioned 0.6 because I went to their table. Children who'd always been exposed to community water fluoridation had mean DMF scores about 18% lower than those who had never lived in fluoridated communities. The results suggest that water fluoridation has played a dominant role in the decline in caries and must continue to be a major prevention methodology. Can you believe that these guys are talking seriously about the saving of 0.6 of one tooth surface? Because that's what they are. Spencer and co-workers in Australia, pro-fluoridation, found a saving of between 0.12 and 0.3 of one tooth surface for in the permanent teeth. I should stress this is permanent teeth. In New Zealand, Betty DeLiefter found that the difference between tooth decay in fluoridated and non-fluoridated communities was clinically meaningless. Locker, for the Ontario government, the magnitude of the effect is not large in absolute terms, is often not statistically significant, and may not be of clinical significance. The latest study from Australia looked at 10,000 children in South Australia and found no statistical difference in tooth decay in the permanent teeth of children who had drunk fluoridated water all their lives and children who drank rainwater or bottled water. No statistical difference. But guess what they proposed? That people fluoridate bottled water. Yeah. And there's a disconnect here, is there not? Well, that's the benefits. Now the precautionary principle. What's the precautionary principle? How has it come about? When exposing a whole population to a toxic substance, you cannot afford to wait until absolutely irrefutable scientific evidence has proved beyond a shadow of a doubt against the pressures of the most invested interests, of which there are many on this issue, there's likely harm. If you do, it could be too late for millions of people. So that's why we have this principle. If in doubt, keep it out. Bellingham, 2005. If in doubt, take it out. Seattle, 2006. Now, applying the precautionary principle, you've got to obviously pass some standards. You can't just have somebody coming along and saying, oh, there's this one study which shows that if you eat beetroots, your toenails fall out, we should stop eating beetroots, period. No, you've got to have some criteria. Here are the criteria that I offer. First question, is there peer-reviewed and published evidence for harm? In this case, clearly, yes. Second question, is the harm plausible from a biological perspective? Osteosarcoma? Yes. Third question, how serious is this health concern if it is real? Osteosarcoma can kill young boys. It is very, very serious. Fourth question, how important is the benefit being pursued? Saving 0.6 of a tooth surface. Are there alternative ways of achieving this benefit? Answer, Europe has demonstrated emphatically, yes, there are alternative ways of doing it. On every count, fluoridation satisfies the precautionary principle. Take it out. Conclusion. The serious health effects posed to many tissues by fluoridation far outweigh any small benefits to teeth. Europe has demonstrated that there are far safer and more acceptable approaches to protecting children's teeth, including the use of xylitol toothpaste, chewing gum, and mints. The three-year NRC review has put the science of fluoride's toxicity clearly on the table for anybody that can read. Unfortunately, many people in government cannot. The CDC dismissal of the relevance of the NRC's findings to water fluoridation without waiting for the US EPA to determine a new MCLG clearly illustrates their political agenda. Hopefully, this is the last gasp of the long-sorted political history of this practice, where many well-intentioned people have been duped by their government on this issue. And you can get the full details of that sordid political history from Chris Bryson's book Outside, which is now available in paperback with a brand new introduction. And you can also get the 30-minute videotaped interview that I had with Chris Bryson down in New York City a couple of years ago, which is a lot quicker to watch than the book to read, but both are important. Seattle. At last we get to Seattle. Sleepless in Seattle, right? You're going to be sleepless tonight. Seattle. Seattle should invoke the precautionary principle, which the city council endorses. Seattle is one of the few cities in the United States which has actually been bold enough to say, we will incorporate the precautionary principle in our decision-making processes. And say, with so many uncertainties identified by the NRC on serious endpoints like brain damage, lowered thyroid function, accumulation in the pineal gland, arthritis, increased hip fractures, etc., we should halt fluoridation now until such time as future experiments, which should have been done 50 years ago, have been performed to resolve these issues. In other words, switch the shoes, folks. You want to do experiments, you lovely little scientists, you can do all the bloody experiments that you want after you've stopped fluoridation. And when you've got your experiments sorted out with animals and in controlled populations, then, and you've got satisfactory results, then you can come back to Seattle, put it on the table, and then we will redecide what we can do. And meanwhile, what we're going to do in Seattle is we're going to target the poor kids, with the people that really need health care. Maybe you can set up clinics with decent dentists who are not just interested in making thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars and treat these kids for nothing. Maybe you can give them xylitol toothpaste and tablets and chewing gum in school. Maybe you can do all of these things. But no more experiments on our population. Thank you.